I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Team Human is listener-supported. We have more listeners than can fit into MetLife Stadium, but only about 300 of them support the show and get the ad-free version of the show on the Team Human team feed, access to our Discord server, free admission to live events, and more. Come to teamhuman.fm and click on support, and you will notice the difference in your experience of life. We are trying something new. On March 7th at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to stream a Team Human Live through YouTube and LinkedIn, where you can all call in to ask questions and participate. Team Human supporters will get first dibs on call-in spots, but it will be open to the world. More on that soon. But for now, set aside March 7th at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You're on Team Human, conscious intervention in the machine, a delightfully corrosive sensibility that breaks the distinctions between subject and object, giving and getting, work and play, upper and lower, highbrow and lowbrow. It's all just what it's becoming. As Popeye insisted, I am's what I am, and I am Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, my kind of scholar, film historian, writer, and legendary college professor, my Queens College Media Studies colleague, Noah Sika.
We're still deep. We're intellectuals. We're smart. We're capable of reading texts. We're not naive spectators. We're not gullible. We know what these generic categories consist of, and that's what we like about them. We like that we understand them. We like that they're familiar to us.
Noah is going to expose us to the brilliance and the most pop of cultural expressions and help us reclaim the wisdom of our own sensibilities. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Noah Tsika is the kind of scholar I always imagined existed, but never quite discovered until I got to Queens College and was assigned to do a teaching observation of him. Well, I just became a student, like 20 minutes in there. I'm just taking notes. I'm back in college and thinking, man, I wish it had been like this. Noah Tsika is a professor of media studies at Queens College, which is part of City University of New York, where I teach. He's the author of Cinematic Independence, Constructing the Big Screen in Nigeria, Screening the Police, Film and Law Enforcement in the United States, Pink 2.0, Encoding Queer Cinema on the Internet, and other books all about film. He just published a crazy good little book called I'm Not There, about the impressionist Bob Dylan biopic of the same name by Todd Haynes. It's a scholarly analysis of the film, but it's also one of those little guilty pleasure reads, kind of like those little books in the 33 and a third series of short books. Remember those about individual albums like Blue Moves or Diamond Dogs? I was supposed to do one about the Yes album, but never quite could get it together, and now the series is over. But he writes like that, you know, where it's just you and the author going deep into an experience that you've both lived. Well, Noah's official specialty is Nollywood cinema. No, do not spell correct that. Nollywood with an N for Nigeria. It's a genre of mostly low-budget movies. Sometimes they're even shot on camcorders, but they're distributed to millions in Nollywood movie theaters and DVDs. And people, like erudite people, kind of deride the whole genre as cheap, dumb pop stuff for the uneducated masses. But we on Team Human know that things that really resonate with people may be doing so for deeper reasons than meet the eye. And judgments to the contrary are usually kind of racist, or at least elitist, and definitely closed-minded and dumb. So don't let today's political excuse for populism change your opinion of pop. For my money, it may just be as deep as things get. But here's my conversation with Noah Tsika. Let it stand as my version of what the best scholarly conversations actually sound like. So I've been interested in your work since I met you, because the first thing I heard you talking about live in person was Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Which I looked at, I mean, because I'm just a pedestrian person who's, you know, I've had lots of different kinds of sex and stuff, but whatever. But I thought, oh, this is like a really good pro-gay movie because there's cowboys having sex and stuff.
Yeah.
So yay.
Yeah.
Yay. One for the team of, you know, people who like gay stuff. And then I was like, listen to your analysis. And it was like, oh, this is like way more complex than
yeah, a lot of queer identified people hate that movie. I'm not one of them. I have to say,
right.
I still love Brokeback Mountain.
Okay,
I think
good.
It's a great melodrama.
Right. But a lot of queer identified people hated it because why?
Because they felt it was ultimately normative, that it ultimately suggested that male same-sex eroticism is a masculinist pursuit. They felt that the film is mired in some regressive ideas about human sexuality. I think it's a lot more interesting than that. I think it's
right.
A lot more complicated.
So
than
they
that.
Were upset that what? That basically that, well, because it's cowboys having sex and they're all kind of straight looking, it means that being gay is okay.
Yeah, it means that being gay is ultimately okay because you're a rough, sexy mountain man and you can pass as straight, and so you're, you know, capable of being accepted by a vast swath of America. And that's presumably what happened when the film Brokeback Mountain became a box office hit, right? So
that
critics of the film
right.
were seeing it as
oh,
a film that people
okay
were embracing,
right.
And that gave them pause because they were so accustomed to the idea of queer cinema as oppositional, as reflecting deeply minoritarian sentiments.
Right. So then certain like gay activists didn't like it because it made homosexuality too like conformist or something.
Yeah, I think certain queer activists are always just inherently skeptical of anything that seems like a crossover hit, right? Like a crossover
right.
success. Anything that's widely embraced beyond the ambit of queer communities.
Well, I can identify with that even like as a punk, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, wait a minute, yeah. Like The Clash, now you're on Columbia Records.
Yep.
And there's a major motion picture. Uh-oh, you're not punk anymore.
Exactly. Well, and, you know, you explored this in Generation Like.
Right.
Right? The question of selling out. And, you know, it's still remarkable that few, if any, of the kids you talk to four-generation like actually had any way of understanding the concept of selling out, right? You said, what does it mean to sell out? And somebody of them said, I don't know.
All
I don't
the
know.
Tickets are gone?
What does that mean? Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that's an idea that in, you know, certain subcultures is still nurtured, right? The idea of selling out, the fear, rather, of selling out is nurtured.
Right. It's always a balance. Like, you want to sell out enough to keep yourself alive, but not so much that you're...
Not so much that you lose your claims to any oppositional identity. Yeah.
Right. Because somehow that's, I like oppositional identity. I don't know. You still have, do you like oppositional identity?
I do. Yeah. I think I'm getting a little more mellow as I get older. I'm 40 now and I'm trying to just be a little more accepting of different viewpoints. Yeah. Right. A little less polemical than I was when I was younger.
Yeah. Right?
Less argumentative, less...
I'm always all is love.
Oh, yeah.
All are welcome, you know.
No, that's good. That's healthy. Yeah.
Well, and you're teaching at a public college with people with lots of different points of view.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. Being here has really helped me to evolve in that way, right? Yeah. To be more accommodating, more, I mean, because we do have such a diverse student body.
I think that helps, especially in the current, sort of Middle East crisis.
Yep.
The fact that it's, we've got, I teach propaganda, right?
Right.
And I had a student for the final propaganda project. They did, as their project, they did a social media video campaign against bail reform.
Wow.
It was like, you've done the crime, you do the time.
You do the time.
Don't let them out. You know, and it's all pictures of black people. And don't let them out or they're going to attack you. And it's like, oh my God. It's like, how do you grade that? What do you think?
Yeah, what do you say? How do you cultivate a discussion about that?
Right. But in some ways, I think, thank God, because at least we're not that strident form of kind of social justice extremism that we're seeing in the elite schools now.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Just that intolerance. You got to be tolerant here.
Right. You can expect to see that level of diversity.
Right.
In the classroom here. Yeah.
Which is great.
It is. You know? It's fantastic. It's so energizing. Yeah.
It is. And it forces a cooperation. There's a lack of, they can't be brittle.
No, they can't be. Everything would fall apart. I mean, the entire campus would just fall apart.
Yeah.
And, students, I think, are aware of the fact that they have to rein themselves into a certain degree in the classroom just to be able to engage in conversations with their peers.
Yeah. I mean, to people who aren't here, it's sort of like teaching class on a New York subway.
Yeah, it is. It is. That's apt. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Yeah, that is true.
So I'm interested in you, like how you, so you would be mostly, you're like a film studies scholar.
Yeah,
I mean, how does that happen? Were you like little watching Space Odyssey going, Mommy, I want to think about this or what?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Southern Maine and I watched a lot of movies and my parents are interested in movies. They definitely fostered a love of film. My father would take me to local video stores to rent VHS cassettes every week when I was a kid. That was my, Friday afternoon treat. Rent a few movies for the weekend.
But what were you renting, Godard or Mothra?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Godard eventually, by high school, would say. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. There was an amazing independent video store, rental store in Portland, Maine, called Videoport. And they had an amazing selection of old films and new films. And so I went there to further my foreign film education.
Right. And what was your, did you have like a, was there a gateway drug from regular movies to the weirder?
There was.
What was that?
The gateway drug really for everything was Pauline Kael. I started reading Pauline Kael's criticism when I was about 13.
For people who don't know, she was the New Yorker. She was like basically every week in the New Yorker, she would write critiques of movies that were these educational. I mean, she could be mean sometimes, but it was always, you'd learn so much looking at it.
Her voice as a writer was so alive, was so vibrant. you know, she leapt off the page, and she's the reason I am still trying to write. She's the reason I wanted to write in the first place. Mm. You know, I started reading her collection Four Keeps when I was 13, and yeah, the New Yorker hired her in 68, and she worked there until 1991, won the National Book Award in 1974 for Deeper Into Movies. Her collections were such amazing guides for me as a kid in Maine. They gave me access to ideas about movies that I hadn't previously encountered. So yeah, she's the reason for all of it, really.
Oh, that's cool. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm this, you know, young, gay, not understood boy in Maine, and I can see the, you know, the urban reality. It was really appreciation of film itself.
It was that. Yeah, I mean, I was definitely a lonely gay kid in Maine. Yeah. And movies helped me to feel less alone, less isolated, more in touch with the world, the wider world. And I felt so connected to Cale's prose.
So then she'd like write about some movies or what, and then you'd
I would seek them out. Yeah, I'd get them. I'd watch them. You know, I would try to see them through her eyes. It wouldn't always work. I would go back to her reviews and think, what is she seeing that I'm not seeing? What does she know that I don't know?
Right.
Or how does she know as much as she knows? And of course, the answer is through a lifetime of learning, right?
Right.
She started writing when she was in her late 40s for The New Yorker. When she published her landmark review of Bonnie and Clyde in 1967, she was close to 50. Mm. So she had decades of study, decades of experience of the art form and of other proximate art forms. And
was
I didn't
she
have
educated?
That. She went to Berkeley as an undergrad. I don't think she completed the degree, but she thought about going on to law school and didn't, and wrote pieces freelance for a number of years, worked as a seamstress, worked as a nanny, and then, you know, finally got that job at The New Yorker after publishing her book, I Lost It at the Movies, in the mid-60s, which is an amazing collection of criticism and polemics.
Yeah, gosh. So then you started watching stuff, and then how did you get like scholarly about it? You went to college?
I did. Yeah. I went to Cornell and loved the environment there. Culturally, socially, it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. But they didn't have and still don't have a film major.
Right.
And so I reluctantly transferred to Dartmouth because Dartmouth did have an amazing film major, a relatively big film department. So I went there to major in film and television studies. So I was mentored by a number of amazing film historians there at Dartmouth and continued my education there, then went immediately to NYU to get my PhD in cinema studies.
And is that when you got into all Nigerian cinema and all that?
Yeah, it was NYU because I studied with Mansha Diawara, who is considered rightly the father of African film studies, took courses with him, and he said, look, just move to Dakar, move to Senegal while you're ABD, while you're finishing your dissertation. Go there and work on it, even though the dissertation is not on African film. Just do it. And I did it. And while I was living in West Africa, I started researching Nollywood. And that became this second track within film studies for me. I mean, I will always be interested in Hollywood. I'll always be interested in U.S. film history. But I'm also committed to the study of African cinema and more specifically Nollywood.
Right. And then, you know, and I was lucky enough because I've sat in a couple of your classes, you know, officially it was originally like as an observer, but then as like student. And it was weird watching these Nollywood movies that are almost like some of them like shot almost in like home video.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then they seem really cheeky and cheap, but then you start watching and going, oh, wait a minute. There's like,
hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Old Nollywood lore being woven into this thing there. Belief in magic and these different scales of, like, for me it was like about retribution. Who gets punished and who doesn't in these movies is way different than
it is.
Us.
So many old Nollywood films, so films made on VHS cassette, right? Straight to video films produced in the early 1990s in southern Nigeria are steeped in the occult. And, you know, the moral economies of the occult come into play in so many of them. And as you say, yeah, questions of justice, questions of retribution, they're so wild. They're so much fun, in my opinion. I love them as genre films. I mean, when I was living in Dakar, I was going to festival screenings and I was going to museum screenings. You know, Dakar is the birthplace of Ousmane Sambène, the father of African cinema, is a place where the art of film is appreciated. There are a lot of film snobs in Senegal, right? There's a culture of appreciation for the moving image and for a certain conception of cinema in Senegal. So when I was living there, I was enjoying all of that, but I was also hearing complaints. I was hearing people say, oh, that fucking Nollywood, that's just the scourge of the continent. They were saying that Nollywood to them represented a regression, that it was the anti-Sambène, anti-art, crass commercial. And I thought, oh God, I've got to see more of this. So it made me develop an appetite for Nollywood. So many people in Senegal were complaining about Nollywood that I knew I had my next project, my next undertaking. So I started to watch Nollywood movies and I just got hooked. I got completely addicted and I'm still addicted to Nollywood movies, as hundreds of millions of people around the world are.
Yeah, because there's this other thing that happens, and it was weird for me because I've always been a lowbrow is highbrow kind of guy.
Yeah, me too.
I like, you know, Beavis and Butthead and Ren and Stimpy and you know, all these things as like, oh no, these are deep.
Yep.
And then maybe because I got more educated lately and, you know, I started to get, okay, I can watch the good Criterion movies and all.
Sure.
And then it was kind of sitting in your class made me think, well, wait a minute, maybe lowbrow is the opposite of what I've been thinking. In other words, that lowbrow in some ways, or the most popular cultural expression of something, is in some ways the most refined because it's been through all of these filters. Like, I've been watching the Viking TV series lately.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And I know they're shit on a certain level, but and they're not accurate to the real Viking history,
but
in some ways they are the most accurate to what are the themes and the what are the mythic underpinnings of Viking lore that have survived and we still relate to now. So it's like, you know, Christ, poor Christ, he's still in the Bible because we still worship him here in this culture and all that. But Thor has made it to pop culture through all these additional filters. Thor, in some ways, is a more advanced god.
Right.
Because he was lost as a something to get worshipped.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I'm in complete agreement with you about that.
Yeah.
And that is central to aspects of Nigerian culture, this idea of lowbrow is highbrow, this refusal to relegate anything to the category of lowbrow.
Well, because then you're relegating yourself to it.
I exactly. mean, there's
yep. it's like, no, yep. we are poor. We are poor. We are uneducated. We are common, but yeah. we are deep.
But we know? Are deep. We're still deep. We're intellectuals. We're smart. We're capable of reading texts. We're not naive spectators.
Right.
We're not gullible. We know what these generic categories consist of, and that's what we like about them. We like that we understand them. We like that they're familiar to us. I go back to that great quote from Dennis Potter, who said that he doesn't make the mistake that high culture mongers make of assuming that because people like cheap art, that their emotions are cheap too. And
right.
Right. I mean, that's Nollywood movies, even at their quote unquote worst, are remarkable reflections of certain societal conflicts and cultural practices that are themselves incredibly deep, rich, meaningful, and contentious.
And do you ever get pushback of being a white American scholar that, oh, you're not allowed to study this stuff?
Yeah, sure. That comes up now and again, and I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, people will continue to resist the idea of someone from the United States, from a non-African background, genuinely enjoying Nollywood movies. And I continue to say that I simply do. I simply love them. I am as addicted to Nollywood movies as to Hollywood movies. And so I study both.
Yeah.
You know, I go back and forth and, you know, I sometimes combine the two. I look at the role of Hollywood in Nigeria. You know, my last book looked at the history of Hollywood studios attempting to infiltrate
right.
the Nigerian market, to develop the Nigerian market, to construct movie theaters and oversee them, influence them. Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting. I mean, the most interesting aspect of that to me is the hand painted Nigerian posters of American movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those, the most famous ones come from Ghana.
Well, they do.
That practice started in Ghana. Yeah. And there's a lot of crossover between Nigeria and Ghana
right.
in terms of video production and the cultures of consumption that we associate with video production. Yeah, those posters are amazing. Posters of Hollywood blockbusters. I mean, my favorite poster is probably the one of Rambo. Even there are so many other ones. I mean, they're all just incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really great.
And it's fun. And it's just so celebratory. And it's localized on a certain
level. Localized, definitely. They're so idiosyncratic and exuberant.
Yeah.
Really?
That's the thing. I feel like in this world, especially the how cynical everyone is, we are starved for exuberance.
We are. We sure are.
You know, so people love Bollywood because they're just like throwing colored dust at each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, breaking into songs, you know, the song and dance routines, the vibrancy of those alone. Yeah.
And it's like we're embarrassed to do that here or something.
We are.
It's kind of sad.
It is.
So then the latest. All right.
Yeah.
So I hadn't seen, I mean, luckily your book, I'm Not There, gave me the excuse to see that movie for the first time.
Oh, good.
Which I hadn't
seen. You hadn't seen it. Yeah. Well, you're not alone. It was not a hit.
It blew my fucking mind. Because it was, so here's the thing. So I'm watching this movie. It was so hard to get my bearings.
Yeah.
It's like, did this happen? Did it not? So,
right.
Describe just what it, for people who don't know what this is.
Sure. Yeah. It's a film that's ostensibly about Bob Dylan, but it doesn't announce that other than through the opening credits when it says, based on the music and many lives of Bob Dylan, right? There's one credit. There's one line that refers to Bob Dylan, but it features six different performers, each playing a version of Bob Dylan, and they're separated by age, by race, by gender, right? So a relatively diverse cast, six individuals portraying aspects of this legendary cultural figure, and not a single one goes by the name Bob Dylan. Each has a different name. The names have varying degrees degrees of relevance to like the Dylan persona. Black kid
Woody Guthrie.
Woody Guthrie, yeah. Who was one of Dylan's inspirations. Right,
or Arthur Rambo.
Yep, Rambo is one. And Jude Quinn, Jack Rollins, Robbie Clark. They all have different names. And so it's a film that plays with the category of the biopic, the generic category of biographical motion pictures. But it's still very much about Bob Dylan. I mean, anyone who knows anything about Bob Dylan will be able to recognize aspects of Dylan's life and career in the film.
Right. And this is, I mean, people don't know, this is Todd Haynes, who did this,
Haynes,
who hopefully is most remembered for his Karen Carpenter story, which was played with Barbie dolls, of which this movie is the closest movie in his arsenal or repertoire to this one.
Yeah, it's really close.
And that was a kind of a biopic of the Karen Carpenter story, and he acted it out with Barbie dolls.
With Barbie dolls and other Barbie knockoffs, each portraying, you know, aspects of Karen Carpenter.
Right, and it was all, I'm sure it was all illegal, that, you know, IP and all these problems.
Yep.
And this one is kind of has some IP legal issues too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. That's what interested me the most, you know. Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story, is this legendary film from 1987 that Todd Haynes made without anyone's permission, right? It sort of started as a project at Bard where he was doing his MFA, and then he transformed it into this amazing commentary on the toxicity of fame, on the pressures placed on female artists like Karen Carpenter. So it explores her struggles with anorexia nervosa, but it also uses unlicensed Carpenter songs to advance the narrative and to comment on certain aspects of the story. And so actually Mattel was the first copyright holder to threaten to sue. Mattel said, look, you use Barbie and we didn't give you permission to use Barbie, so we're going to sue you. And then Richard Carpenter and A&M Records actually succeeded in bringing a suit against Todd Haynes and, you know, getting the film pulled from theatrical distribution. So it has circulated in bootleg forms ever since.
Well, and at those banned film festivals where
banned
I first
film
saw
festivals, you can't licitly distribute it or exhibit it. You can't commercially exhibit it anywhere under the terms of that injunction from Richard Carpenter and A&M Records. But when Todd Haynes decided to make this movie about Bob Dylan, or decided that he wanted to make a movie about Bob Dylan, he said to himself, I don't want to make that mistake again. I can't risk, you know, putting years of my life into this project only to have it squashed
by lawyers. Well, because this one's like a real movie with actors and sets. And
yeah, exactly. It was a, you know, $20 million production. And so before he even wrote the script, he contacted Dylan's people and said, look, is this in the realm of possibility? He sent Dylan a proposal, and Dylan said, yeah, sure. Which was a shock to everyone.
I mean, he's a cantankerous sort of dude.
Absolutely. Oh, among the most litigious of all recording artists. I mean, he's legendarily litigious, I'll say that. So this was a surprise, a pleasant surprise for Todd Haynes, especially since in 1998, David Bowie said, I don't want to be involved in your work. Haynes had wanted to make a film essentially about David Bowie, Velvet Goldmine. And, you know, Bowie refused to license his music to the production. So Haynes had to scramble and rewrite a lot of it and come up with alternatives to Bowie. So, you know, he ended up licensing some Roxy Music pieces for the film to sort of stand in for Bowie's music. But he said, you know, I either go all the way with this or I don't make it at all. I either use Bob Dylan's music with permission, right? I either license, you know, a dozen or more of these songs, or I just don't make this movie at all.
But then this movie ends up being like this, for me, like a fever dream.
Yeah.
Really strange. And I'll like look at a scene in it and go, wait a minute, that's the cover of that album. Then a scene is gone.
Right, exactly.
So he throws out stuff at you without taking credit, without calling attention. It's like, if you noticed it, cool. If you didn't, it's gone.
Exactly.
Right? Who does that? You know?
Who does that? I mean, the boldness of Todd Haynes in this film to rely on so many unacknowledged quotations.
Right.
Right. He is pulling from so many different sources. And if you don't know that he's doing that, then you might think he's just making it all up, right? That everything is an invention of Todd Haynes, when in fact he is pulling together all of these different sources. He is citing old movies. He is citing old songs. He's playing those old songs back because he had the rights to the Dylan music. It's all there. Yeah. So unacknowledged quotations form part of the fabric of the film. And you're right. They fly by so quickly, right? You can easily miss so many of them.
Yeah. The visual references too.
Oh, the reproductions of album covers that you mentioned are amazing. Yeah. So many.
And then
Dylan
you start to
covers.
Realize probably everything in that movie is something. You know, I'm catching 10% of them maybe.
Pretty much. Yeah. So I tried to identify as much as possible in the book, you know, to just provide some kind of guide to the allusions, some guide to the citations, the lifts, right, the steals.
Yeah, but the joy of it for me, I mean, and what sort of team human-y about it for me is that it suggests a different relationship to history.
Yeah, exactly.
Not this factual chronology, but it's a swirl of themes that we actively derive meaning from. It's
definitely.
Like, so the reception. So that's the thing that Haynes is doing. The person receiving it in the audience is an active participant in this movie.
That's right. Yep. And I write in the book that Haynes really respects the audience. He has talked about that over the years, how he as a filmmaker, as a writer director, wants to respect you, respect the audience, allow the audience to come to conclusions about his work. So he gives you just enough. He doesn't tell you exactly how to interpret the material. He doesn't, and I'm not there, provide the sources for his citations. He lets you figure that out, right? If you recognize that Marcus Carl Franklin, the 13-year-old who plays Woody Guthrie, a version of Bob Dylan in the film, is directly quoting the 1957 Ilya Kazan film, A Face in the Crowd. Great. If you know that, great. If you don't, fine.
Right.
Right. I'm not going to tell you exactly where these quotations are coming from. I'm not even going to tell you that they're quotations. You have to figure that out.
Right. And even
you
if
have
you
to make
don't,
sense of that.
It's as if you're trusted that you get it on a subconscious, like an Finnegan's Wake sort of a way.
Yes, exactly. Yep. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. Because presumably you have, if only through cultural osmosis, been exposed to these precedents.
We're living in Dylan's America.
Exactly.
So it's like Bob Dylan as media environment rather than as human.
Yep. Yeah, the media ecologies of Dylan.
Yeah.
You know, the tributaries that have fed his art are also feeding this film. And so there are direct references to some of Dylan's most famous influences, like Woody Guthrie, but there are less direct and even hypothetical references to, you know, sources that might have influenced him, sources that conceivably influenced him, that arguably influenced him, like A Face in the Crowd.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Dylan is notoriously elusive. He is someone whose tale should be trusted, but who as a teller is hard to trust, right? He's
well, like Bowie, actually.
Like Bowie, right. What can you take at face value? Reading the man's interviews, you know, reading transcripts of his conversations, what can you actually accept at face value? What actually happened? What's true? What is just a ruse? What is a lie he's telling in the moment? What is something that he's going to contradict in the next interview? You don't know. You can't predict. Right? Perhaps Dylan himself doesn't know how he feels about
any one of a number of historical precedents that he's mentioning in his work.
Right.
And that's all, and I'm not there. As you say, it's nonlinear, it's exploratory. It covers a lot of ground, but it doesn't feel like a dissertation. It doesn't feel like a duty to sit through the film. It's so
right.
Back to this notion of exuberance. It's an exuberant film. The exuberant comes from the energy with which Haynes approached the project, the vitality that the performers bring to it. I mean, Cate Blanchett as Jude Quinn, Cate Blanchett playing probably the most iconic version of Bob Dylan, the most recognizable version right. of Bob Dylan, the version that we associate with the Pennebaker film Don't Look Back from 1967, covering the 1965 tour, Dylan's tour of the UK. Those images that are reproduced in the Cate Blanchett
right.
sections are pretty recognizable around the world.
Right. Is that when he met John Lennon and did all
yeah.
that?
Yeah. He met Lennon a little later.
Because I saw a crazy movie once where they're like...
Eat the document.
In the back of a limo and yep. they've just done smack.
Exactly.
And it's yeah. like Dylan wasn't used to smack and he's all nauseous. Yep. And John Lennon's like giving him a hard time.
Yeah, John Lennon's fine. John Lennon, you know, he's serene. He's has his wits about him and Dylan is just, you know, reeling and yeah. presumably ready to puke. But yeah, that happened in 1966 during Dylan and the Hawks' tour of Europe, which is a tour that Dylan filmed for a project that he was doing for ABC for television. But that was never really finished, although he managed to copyright it in 1971. It's a movie called Eat the Document that Haynes takes some footage from in I'm Not There.
The thing about the I'm Not There movie that and your treatment of it that gives me such hope is this moment that we're in culturally. For me, it's really dark, and it's yeah. part of the reason why it's so awful is this, and I blame digital for it, although you can't blame digital for everything, I like to. I blame digital for it, this everybody wants a definition.
Yes.
What happened when and then? Who's to blame? Who's not? Who's right. more culturally oppressed? Who's less? Who gets to talk? Yeah. Who doesn't? What's exactly your intersection? More than my intersection? Less than my intersection? And I'm Not There and Todd Haynes and say, to some extent, even David Lynch does this,
right.
is like saying, yo, it's all ambivalent. It's all yeah. the joy of being human is in opening these questions that are unanswerable and juxtapositions of things that human beings can do something
exactly.
if we stay open
yeah.
in the liminal spaces between stuff. Which, are you gay or you're straight? I don't fucking care.
Right.
Are you straight acting gay or gay acting straight? Whatever. I'm this human in between these lines.
Exactly.
Todd gets that, right?
Yeah.
Lynch gets that in his own way. Dylan seems to have gotten that. You seem to get this. The Nollywood cinema seems to get this.
Yeah.
You know, this liminal place.
Absolutely.
It's so fun to be there. But
it
so,
sure is. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that, you know, ambivalence is a condition of modernity, but you remind me that it's the condition of humanity.
Right.
Right? Ambivalence, ambiguity. There's this great lyric in Dylan's song, Desolation Row. Everybody's singing, which side are you on? Right? This demand that you take sides. Identify yourself. Identify yourself for me. For my edification, for my identity. Tell me exactly where you stand so that I can predict your movements. And this film rejects that.
Right.
As arguably Dylan's career rejects that.
Well, because it's dehumanizing. If you want
Absolutely.
To predict my movements, you're saying
yeah.
you want to dehumanize me and turn me into a fucking robot.
Yeah, fuck you.
Right.
Fuck you.
And Dylan knew how to say that. He really
knew
did.
How to say that. He wasn't afraid to say that, right? He wasn't afraid to say that at 21 in the 60s. He's not afraid to say it now. Todd Haynes isn't afraid to say it, although he's an incredibly kind man.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Todd Haynes is really laid back. He's not an adversarial personality, but his work is challenging. It challenges this notion of fixity that I think is, for some reason that I can't quite understand, being embraced and promoted in the name of progressivism today. And that's not the progressivism I remember from my youth. Right. That's not the queer theory that I learned in college and grad school. Right. No. This embrace of fixity, this embrace of identitarian approaches to anything and everything, the fluidity that's examined and I'm Not There, I think remains really inspiring.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I remember did this talk for a conference in 1999. I think it was 99. It was called Disinfo, right? It was for Richard Metzger, this conference. And I had to do like the opening little keynote for it. And I was like, it was for the counterculture. And I said, all right, we won. Now what?
Now what?
We won. You accept that you won, that the counterculture is about to become the overculture, then are we going to bring forward the flexibility and fluidity, or are you all going to try to lock down? If you lock it down, you're no better than the fucking Bush people you just replaced.
Exactly. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. That's the fear, right? That's a perennial concern.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's my problem with revolution, right?
Yeah.
It goes in a circle.
Yeah.
I want renaissance is what I always talk about.
Renaissance, well, because it implies an ongoing process. It implies a process that can't be completed, right? A process that might be quashed, that might be supplanted, but that in theory can persist indefinitely as this flowering of artistic expression, of open conversation, of debate, right? It's a really productive word.
Yeah, I'm excited about your work, especially the trajectory, because as I look at, I mean, this is my judgment of your trajectory, my perception of it, is that it went from, you know, like really more academic scholarly to this book, I'm Not There, which, who's the publisher of this? University, it says University of Texas Press, but it looks to me like an OR book.
Or
a little Verso book. It's so, I mean, everyone should first see the fucking movie, but get this little book, I'm Not There. And it's like, this is not like film theory hard to read.
No.
It's just you, it's this nice little book that makes you go, this is just cool. It's like, remember those books that they did about, what were they called? About those, the records? It was this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like great albums. And they had these little books. They were called 2020s or something.
33 and a third.
Yeah, 33 and a third, I think they were called. And it was like of a great album. And it was just a way to get into like the Yes album or whatever.
Yeah.
And this is a way to get into a movie that it's an invitation. And it's like, it's so, it is not self-indulgent. It is not decadent to embrace this core human experience, especially right now. It feels, it is political on a certain level.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. And I keep returning to this film because I find it so inspiring, because the ideas that Haynes expresses through it are still so relevant. I remember seeing it for the first time when it came out and thinking, oh yeah, this is how I want to live. This is how I want to think. Mm. This is how I want to proceed, certainly intellectually.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, I came here to Queens, we're in a social justice program. And at when I started here, I started to discard all of my kind of work in the arts as superfluous to the struggle, to the mission, to the, you know, if we're not getting them in the streets. And now I'm realizing, as I look at the brittleness of American society, our incapacity of dealing with crisis, I'm realizing, oh, no, the arts and teaching people about ambiguity and wiggle room and confusion is necessary training to be able to hold and bear witness to what's happening.
Yeah, definitely.
This is essential work. This is This is not for when we happen to have time. No.
Right.
No.
And, you know, in fact, there's an amazing moment in the film that alludes to the question of whether Bob Dylan can be classified as reactionary, as regressive, as even right-wing in some ways. And the answer that the film implies is you can't possibly know. You can't possibly know what his politics are or that they can ever be
pinned down. And so this idea of someone like Bob Dylan as cancelable because of a reference that he once made to the Civil War is one that we should interrogate, right? We shouldn't accept it at face value, that Bob Dylan has examined aspects of American history that today seem deeply unseemly, but that doesn't mean he endorses the racism of the past. That doesn't mean that he himself is racist. That doesn't mean that his career represents the right wing in any meaningful sense. You know, we don't have access to another person's subjectivity.
I never want to cancel someone based on their work. You know, their Piss Christ or Mapplethorpe in the butt, whatever you're doing. No. You know, I'll cancel you if you Harvey Weinstein'd humans in your life. You know, all right, get out of my fucking face. But I don't want to know you.
Right.
But the work, this is the place. This is the dream. This is the go where you got to go, buddy. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that the two strands intersect in the case of I'm Not There, because Haynes himself was quote unquote canceled in the early 1990s. You know, he was, you know, classified alongside Serrano and Mapplethorpe because he made films that were disruptively queer. like Poison. He makes Poison in 1991. Mm. And, you know, he had received some public funding, some public arts funding for his work. And so, of course, congressional Republicans spoke out against that and said that, you know, he was using taxpayer money to promote deviance, sexual and otherwise. And so he was described as a figure not unlike Mapplethorpe in the early 1990s, but he himself stood by his work and said what you just said, that, you know, the work is the work. You don't know who I am in my private life, what I do. Watch the film and let me know what you think about the film. Don't tell me who I am morally, right? Don't define my identity for me. But then who distributes I'm Not There? The Weinstein Company, right? Harvey Weinstein was heavily involved in the distribution and marketing of I'm Not There. And after the scandal really erupted in 2017, the Weinstein Company went bankrupt, of course. The scandal-induced bankruptcy auction was held. And so the rights to the distribution of I'm Not There were kind of in flux for a little while there. So, yeah, the film itself embodies a lot of different contentious issues.
Yeah. So maybe in closing, I'm interested, where do you see yourself going next? And what are you, if you do, I mean, I always do this because the world's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of where do you see your work playing a role in, if it does, in helping us avert just utter human catastrophe? That's
a light question with which to end, a softball question, if you will.
Well, the teaching is one. I mean, just the fact that you're teaching 200 or 300 people a semester is helping humans. You know?
Well, it helps me personally. Mm. I mean, I had a really rough time a couple of weeks ago, and I so looked forward to just being in the classroom. Mm. It really helps. We have some amazing students here, and just the environment here has always been, I mean, good for me. I mean, I love it here. But apart from that, I'll say I'm working on two books right now. One is a history of the idea of forever war, of endless war, perpetual war, and the relationship between that idea and Hollywood history. So how we can examine the development of Hollywood as an industry in relation to actual wars that are seemingly interminable. So how do we further examine the relationship between Hollywood and the U.S. military? How did individual films articulate the notion of war as endless?
Well, it's like part of the human condition.
Yeah. Exactly. So that is a topic that I hope people will find endlessly relevant, right? And my other book project is on the relationship between African natural resources and screen media. Huh. And it really focuses on Nigerian resources, coal and tin and oil and films, Hollywood films, African films, films from all around the world. And, you know, the argument is rooted in this idea that there's no standing outside of that reliance on African natural resources. All of our devices rely on them. So how do we deal with that? How do we make sense of that? How do we can't deny that.
Especially all the crazy new supposedly renewable things. It's like, no, you're getting rare earth metals. That's not renewable.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Molybdenum's not renewable.
No, you're still extracting from the African continent. There's no way around that. So, you know, what do we do with that knowledge?
We took from their people. We extracted the people from the continent.
The people and stuff. Still, I mean, you know, we can talk about decarbonization here in the United States, but that's presumably going to be dependent on the ongoing extraction of resources from Africa.
Right.
Right. The ongoing use of Africa as a dumping ground. I mean, Ghana and the e-waste piles there. It's another depressing story.
Yeah, but another perpetual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. That's the other theme, right? These issues don't go away. We might think that they do. We might think that we've solved them, but
right. They we just insulate don't. Ourselves from them better, right?
We do. Yeah. We
dumbwaiter effect.
Yeah.
They're down in the basement. Don't think about them.
Yeah. Out of sight, out of mind. Right.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for your work. Thanks for making me proud of the fact that I'm a film lover rather than embarrassed of it.
Thank you. Yeah,
it's great.
Don't be ashamed. No.
No. And for loving the shitty ones, the supposedly shitty ones, because you can go deep. Mothra and Gamera are deep.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. No, they all are. I mean, you can find allegory just about anywhere.
Yeah.
No.
Beautiful. All right.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Douglas.
Thanks. And thank you for being on Team Human. Our guest today was Noah Tsika, the author of a whole bunch of titles on the joys and power of Nigerian cinema, as well as the new book, I'm Not There, about the Bob Dylan biopic. You can find links to all of his stuff on the show in the You can find links to all of his stuff in the show notes to this episode of Team Human. Team Human was produced by Joshua Chapdelaine and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.